Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, February 20th, 2026. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. Today's cover page features a story about the avalanche in California, another story about federal funding for the Arizona Trail, and a story regarding the ongoing dispute between the county recorder and the county commissioners. The featured photo on today's cover page is of a woman in a sheriff's uniform standing at a podium with three deputies behind her. The caption reads, "Authorities are investigating the totality of the avalanche that killed eight people," Nevada County Sheriff Shannon Moon said at a news conference February 18th, which includes finding out why the trip wasn't canceled. It accompanies a USA Today article titled, "Avalanche Killed Eight Despite Warnings, Tour Guide Company Facing Tough Questions," by Amanda Lee Myers and Tao Nguyen. The warnings were clear and eerie. A winter storm warning forecast of up to 8 feet of snow in California's Lake Tahoe region, and avalanche conditions were considered very dangerous. Blackbird Mountain Guides, now under scrutiny for its role in the deadliest avalanche in the United States in four decades, had multiple social media posts that acknowledged possible avalanche threats in the region. "Big storm incoming," one post read on February 15th. "Avalanches could behave abnormally, and the hazard could last longer than normal." That same day, an ill-fated group of 11 clients, led by four guides with Blackbird Mountain Guides, left for a three-day trip that would end in tragedy. They went to a pristine alpine lake called Frog Lake, just a few miles north of the infamous Donner Party disaster of 1847. They stayed in the hard-to-reach Frog Lake huts for two nights and enjoyed a full day of backcountry skiing. But on the third and final day of the trip, an avalanche came crashing down, killing three guides and five guests and leaving six survivors. A ninth person was not found and is presumed dead. As families grieve and crews come up with a plan to remove the bodies from the mountain when it's safe, the guiding company is facing a tough question. Given the known dangers, why did they still go? The area where the avalanche occurred is known for its beauty, its skiing, and its danger. The Donner Land Trust, which owns the Frog Lake area, says on its website that all areas are uncontrolled avalanche terrain that require appropriate avalanche education and equipment. Winter wilderness travel is not to be taken lightly. All visitors must understand people die every year in the backcountry, the Donner Land Trust said. Ahead of the storm, the Sierra Avalanche Center issued an avalanche watch for the area at 7:45 a.m., the day the group set out. Forecasters had warned of avalanche danger in the days leading up to the watch as well. "A powerful storm with rapidly accumulating snowfall and strong winds may cause widespread avalanche activity in the mountains," the watch said. "Very dangerous avalanche conditions could occur in the backcountry. Traveling in, near, or below backcountry avalanche terrain during high avalanche danger is not recommended." The warnings were strong enough that Kurt Geischmeier said he made sure to be out of the region before the snow hit. The avid backcountry skier stayed with the group in the Frog Lake huts from February 12th to 15th, the day the group, led by Blackbird Mountain Guides, arrived, reported the Reno Gazette Journal, part of the USA Today network. "We planned to leave before the storm came in," Geischmeier told the Gazette Journal. "I think the main thing with this storm is that it was a massive amount of snow in a short time, on top of a snowpack that hadn't seen very much snow in over a month." He said he knows some guides with the Black Mountain Guides and said those who go out in the region where the avalanche occurred are highly experienced and know what they're doing. Still, he called the fatal avalanche a 100% preventable tragedy. "We love to play in the snow, and we do it for fun and enjoyment," he said, "but it's also really serious, sad business." Authorities are investigating the totality of the tragedy, Nevada County Sheriff Shannon Moon said at a news conference February 18th. That includes finding out why the trip wasn't canceled. "Lots of forecasts on this storm," Moon said. "These are the decisions that the guide company clearly had made. We're still in conversation with them on the decision factors that they made." she said, getting to the bottom of the major question surrounding the tragedy as her top priority. I think that's the core piece of my mind, is wanting to be able to provide answers to the families that were affected, the guide members that were present, and the clients that paid for this trip, she said. Moon added that the company has been very cooperative and wanted to do everything they could to assist in the search and rescue efforts following the avalanche. Black Mountain Guides did not respond to a USA Today email on February 18th asking why the company moved forward with the trip given the advanced storm warnings. The company released a statement the day of the avalanche to say its leadership team was working in full cooperation with the Nevada County Sheriff's Office and the Nevada County Search and Rescue to support the ongoing rescue operation. The key factors that should be considered when assessing avalanche dangers, said Myron Allen, a volunteer ski patroller and chair of the National Ski Patrol's National Board of Directors. One is weather, the second is terrain, and the third is snowpack, Allen told USA Today, adding that it is critical to consider recent heavy snowfall and the steepness of the terrain. Although Allen declined to comment on the Blackbird Mountain Guide's trip, he said many avalanche accidents occur when there is insufficient planning. I'm very interested in seeing what the final reports look like, he said. I feel very bad to learn about a guided party running into such a devastating avalanche accident. Maybe we can learn by understanding how the events unfolded. When asked why people venture into the backcountry despite heightened risks, Allen said the appeal of the terrain and the isolation may play roles. Just speaking from personal experience, the mountains are beautiful in winter, Allen said. I think people are just drawn to the wild beauty and the solitude of the mountains covered in snow. I think that's the main motivation. Also, it can be quite fun to ski and snowboard in the backcountry. Allen advised people who want to travel to the backcountry to pay very careful attention to the forecast and to the terrain you choose to travel on. He also recommended that people get avalanche training, learn how to travel in the backcountry, plan ahead, look at maps to figure out where the steep terrain is, and have a backup plan. Jaden Young of the Reno Gazette-Journal contributed to this article. Next up, environmental reporter Joan Miners pens a story titled, Feds Put Arizona Trail Funding at Risk. State bill that would help offset losses advances. Arizonans love their public lands, based on widespread use, decades of investments, and a new survey of voter attitudes. But that won't fully protect the shared spaces from a surge of federal attacks targeting conservation rules, management funding, and protective regulatory efforts, Western land experts say. An appropriations bill to support the Arizona Trail, the state's national scenic trail that attaches nearly every category of public land along its 850-mile route between Mexico and Utah, has advanced partway through the state legislature. The $500,000 requested from the state general fund would help offset sweeping federal cuts to land management agencies and staff. Passage may also signal political backing for public lands that could play out on related fronts. Alone, advocates say, state funding is an incomplete defense against the Trump administration's broad-scale dismantling of the science-based laws and guidelines that have sustained generational access to many of America's favorite outdoor places and programs. We used to get pretty consistent funding from the Bureau of Land Management, but that disappeared a year ago, and then all of our recent requests and grant applications to the BLM have not been approved, said Matt Nelson, who directs the Arizona Trail Association and worked with State Senator Wendy Rogers, Republican of Flagstaff, to introduce the appropriations proposal as Senate Bill 1041. That agency has taken a big hit, and partners like us are seeing it. The money would be used for trail maintenance and construction of reroutes, which Nelson said cost about $40,000 per mile. It would also free up more of the Arizona Trail Association's approximately $1.5 million annual budget, amassed through a patchwork of donations, grants, fundraisers, merchandise sale, and membership fees for staffing and programs that engage Arizona youth, girls, veterans, and others in volunteer opportunities designed to build community while donating about $1 million in labor costs to the improvement of state recreation resources. State support has been unreliable and inconsistent over the years, Nelson said, leaving a backlog of needed work. That's despite the trail's bipartisan popularity evidenced this year by its appropriation bill being sponsored by a well-known far-right conservative. Rogers did not respond to the Arizona Republic's request for further insight into her leadership on outdoor recreation funding. She has said publicly that she enjoys using the trail and feels it enhances her district. Public lands have a long history of bridging political divides in ways few other issues can. In poll results released February 18th, Colorado College's State of the Rockies report found that a majority of nearly 3,500 Western voters surveyed viewed natural habitat losses, rollbacks of environmental laws, and land management funding cuts as serious problems. Between 81% and 89% of those queried across 8 states say conservation issues are important in deciding whether to support an elected official. And though the rising cost of living was a universal concern, 9 out of 10 respondents still supported using federal dollars to purchase and incorporate private holdings into parks and other public areas. These opinions spanned party lines and were shared by Trump-supporting Republicans, though to a slightly lesser degree, the survey found. The views have also become more widely held over time, with 85% of polled voters marking public lands, waters, and wildlife as important issues for them in 2026, compared with 75% in 2016. This year, a majority of Republicans even emphasized the desire to protect natural resources as more than just energy products, up 62% from 48% in 2019. In Arizona, as Colorado River negotiations continue to stall and memories of last summer's devastating fires at the Grand Canyon remain fresh, voters were especially concerned about inadequate water supplies and recent layoffs of wildland firefighters. Arizona also topped the list of Western states on enthusiasm for dark skies, limiting light pollution, and for conservation as a public lands priority. These voter results come as one of the strongest federal tools for incorporating conservation into land use decisions, known as the Public Lands Rule, is under review by the Trump administration. It's just one of many environmental regulations the White House has labeled as unnecessarily obstructive to business and too expensive. Aaron Weiss, deputy director of the nonpartisan conservation organization Center for Western Priorities, expects to see that Biden-era provision show up on the White House's formal chopping block soon after plans to rescind it were announced in September, with the administration also declaring on February 12th its elimination of the endangerment finding and thus the legal foundation for nature preservation through greenhouse gas reductions. U.S. protections for public lands are tipping into a precarious position against the trend of bipartisan support. We see every year there are very few hard gaps with what voters say matters on public lands, Weiss told the Republic. It's not rocket science, and yet you don't see that translating into policy at the federal level, certainly not right now. The Arizona Trail as a symbol of public lands support in the state. What happens next with SB 1041, the measure to allocate $500,000 from state general fund for construction and maintenance of the Arizona Trail, may foreshadow whether Arizona lawmakers will take a stand for public lands. The bill passed in the Senate Committee on Natural Resources with unanimous support, one member was absent, on February 10th, but it was bumped from the committee agenda twice before being heard, raising some concerns that its advancement was not guaranteed. Next, it will be debated by the Senate Appropriations Committee before going to the Senate floor for a vote, then on to the House. In that chamber, Representative Mark Frinchum, Republican of Oro Valley, has expressed skepticism about funding public lands. In 2019, he voted against the bill to put the Arizona State Parks Heritage Fund back into the state statute. It still passed with a 54-6 vote and was signed into law by then-Governor Doug Ducey. But Finchum maintains that funding for outdoor spaces should be considered on a case-by-case basis after other priorities. The state has 4 primary responsibilities, including transportation infrastructure, public safety, education, and providing care for those who cannot care for themselves, the developmentally disabled, Finchum wrote to the Republic this week. Once we have paid for these priorities, and if there is any room on the budget, then we can visit funding for the trail then. His hesitancy will be challenged by lawmakers, such as Senator Priya Sundaresan, Democrat of Tucson, who voiced enthusiasm for this year's funding bill. Democrats proudly supported this bill to fund the Arizona Trail in the Natural Resources Committee, while the Republicans were not universally in support, Sundaresan told the Republic. Democrats believe supporting our public lands and other services that benefit regular Arizonans is a better use of our state's limited resources than a Republican proposal for yet another tax cut that favors private jet owners and the wealthiest. Differing values about how to spend state funds and manage public lands are also at odds in another GOP-introduced bill that advanced through the state Senate Natural Resources Committee on February 17th. Senate Bill 1336 seeks to increase oversight of the Arizona State Lands Department in response to poor performance reviews. State Representative Gail Griffin, Republican of Hereford, sponsored that bill and indicated in a press release that she hopes it will make it easier to sell state-owned land to fund education and meet housing demands. In a 2024 analysis, the Republic found that Griffin had introduced more anti-environmental legislation than any other lawmaker in the previous 2 years. Sunday Ration voted against the bill in committee, along with Senator Teresa Hathaway, Democrat of Coal Mine, Mesa. In contrast, at least for now, the committee hearing last week for SB 1041 to fund the Arizona Trail was short, sweet, and uncontroversial. Sam Richard, a Capitol lobbyist and Arizona Trail Association board member who identified himself as an Eagle Scout, spoke in favor of the bill, reminding committee members that the Arizona Trail has the distinction of being one of only 11 in the nation designated as a national scenic trail. Another speaker read a letter sent in by author Tom Zollner, a former Republic reporter and Arizona Trail finisher who wrote a historical biography of the state called Rim to River that is based on locations on the trail. "I am especially happy that the sponsor of this worthy measure happens to be Senator Rogers," Zollner wrote. "I don't share her politics and disagree with her on many questions, but we do agree on a love for the state and the sentiment that the trail is deserving of some level of public support. This is a powerful illustration of the unifying symbolism behind this important cultural and recreational resource that binds the state together, regardless of party preference. The bigger picture? That's not good for anyone." The appropriations debate over funding for the Arizona Trail will take place not only amid other fights over public lands in Arizona, but against the national backdrop of drastic regulatory repeal and controversial agency nominations. In addition to the upcoming public lands rule revision and last week's repeal of the 2009 endangerment finding that had made climate warming gases eligible for regulation, the Trump administration has also moved to weaken the Endangered Species Act, which could open up land currently protected as critical species habitat. Immediately after taking office, President Donald Trump initiated the now final removal of the 1969 National Environmental Policy Act that required environmental impacts and public input to be considered before breaking ground on major federal projects. And in September, he proposed expanding cattle grazing leases beyond the limits scientists say are sustainable and initiated repeal of the 2001 Roadless Area Conservation Rule that restricted road building through pristine wilderness areas. Many of these actions will face lengthy legal challenges, but in the meantime, lasting damage may be done. Weiss of the Center for Western Priorities worries about the rule repeals and legal breaches trending more bold. Over the past month, the Trump administration has illegally removed signage at national park and historic sites that explain slavery or climate change. The rewriting of history stuff is really awful, particularly when it comes to tribal engagement and tribal history, Weiss said. He's also warily watching the GOP's newly expansive use of the Congressional Review Act to attack public lands protections for areas like Minnesota's Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Local opponents fear water pollution and wilderness degradation in the name of foreign mining interests, while bigger picture concerns center around the precedent of all this sets. There's also the widespread cuts to research on sustaining healthy ecosystems and of the staff that's doing work in federally protected places. All told, Weiss suspects the ultimate goal is to cripple the system of public lands management so thoroughly that it will be easy for lawmakers to declare selling off these public assets as the only solution. The overall theme here is the Trump administration and then Congress is tying the hands of these agencies so they can't do their job, Weiss said. At the end of the day, that's not good for anyone. Similar concerns underpin opposition to several of Trump's picks to lead the nation's land management agencies. Steve Pierce is just a massive risk, Weiss said of Trump's nominee to head the Bureau of Land Management. This is a guy who spent his entire career trying to sell off public lands. He ran bills every session he was in Congress, similar to Utah Senator Mike Lee, trying to find ways to sell off public lands. He tried to strip wilderness protections. He opposed the creation of a national monument in New Mexico, his home state, that people love and have built an outdoor recreation economy around. Pierce's track record on public lands management in Congress makes him totally unqualified, and that's before you even get into conflicts of interest, Weiss said. Pierce has financial entanglements with mineral mining, oil drilling, the sale of water rights, and various real estate ventures that a long list of environmental groups have called out as inappropriate for someone poised to oversee 245 million acres of public lands and 700 million acres of mineral estate. His nomination has the support of some rancher groups and the wary attention of hunters and anglers. I think a man of the soil ought to run that organization, Fincham told the Republican in response to a question about Pierce. My position on disposing land sold by the federal government under proprietary interests only have not changed. Fincham declined to elaborate for the Republic what he means by man of the soil, whether he supports the nomination or his exact position on the disposal of public lands. But Nelson of the Arizona Trail Association said this will be the first time its organization has ever opposed a nominee. Usually they're benign positions, the Arizona Trail director said. But with Pierce, he's been quoted as saying that most of the BLM lands we don't even need, which is a huge concern for somebody who's going to be leading the agency that is the largest land manager in the entire U.S. Trump's more recent nomination of Scott Socha to lead the National Park Service was also met with dismay by environmental groups, yet appears to be moving forward to confirmation. Many critics allege that his longtime corporate leadership of Delaware North, a major concessions operator at many national park sites, is a clear conflict of interest when it comes to doing what is best for these publicly owned natural wonders. He's also been reported to have made large contributions to the company's political action committee and to several Republican candidates. We are facing more and more attacks on public lands for Republicans, both at the federal level and in the state legislature, who would prefer to privatize these lands for their cronies to profit, says Sundaration in response to questions about Trump's federal agency nominations. For Nelson, how SB 1041 progresses at the state legislature over the coming weeks and months will tell him everything he needs to know about whether Arizona will take a meaningful stand for public lands. When the state makes the commitment to appropriate land to this Arizona Trail Fund, the state, which is us, of course, because the legislators represent us, we are saying that we are committed to maintaining and improving this resource that in itself, on principle, is valuable, he said. I think if people love the Arizona Trail and participating in outdoor recreation, which we know they do, I'd encourage them to contact their elected officials and tell them to vote in favor of public lands. Joan Miners is the climate news and storytelling reporter at the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. Email her at joan.meiners@arizonarepublic.com. You can access our programs by going to our website. Go to sunsounds.org. Click the link labeled Broadcast, Info, and Audio. You'll see a box on the left side of the page labeled Programming Links with a link to Listen Live or a link for on-demand programs. We turn to the ongoing battle between the county recorder and the county commissioners with an article titled Heap Distances Self from His Chief, Denies Current Voter Disenfranchisement by Ronald J. Hansen. Maricopa County Recorder Justin Heap distanced himself from the sworn testimony of his chief of staff that there is voter disenfranchisement happening now, but yielded little other ground in his year-long dispute with the Board of Supervisors. Heap said he could not speak for Sam Stone, his chief, and noted that Stone has obtained his own lawyer without explaining why. Stone may have misspoken in a January 26th court hearing in suggesting that disenfranchisement was happening now, Heap said, but Heap maintained that it had happened in the past. I think what Stone meant to say was that it happened in the past and we are making sure it doesn't happen. Heap told the board in a special meeting packed with his supporters, many of whom feared the board would seek to oust Heap. I have certainly spoken to my staff. We have not seen any evidence of that so far this year, that this machine has caused any disenfranchisement. Even by the end of his explanation to the five-member board, when it was clear the board did not intend to take action against Heap, the recorder would not even agree to return to answer questions on other election administration and budget-related matters he provided to the board. Three of the four Republican supervisors in the five-member board repeatedly made clear that they viewed Heap, a fellow Republican, as an unreliable and needlessly combative partner as the county gerged for the 2026 elections locked in litigation and with presumptions of bad faith. Relations between the board and Heap curdled even before he took office, when the board settled on its current power-sharing agreement with Heap's predecessor in a way that handed more responsibilities to the board. Board members urged Heap to engage with them on a revised plan detailing their duties that has lingered unresolved for more than a year and is at the heart of a lawsuit that could soon receive a final ruling. "We are so close," said Supervisor Debbie Lesko, a Republican, on a still-pending plan considered 95% complete in April 2025. "I don't know what we're arguing about. I feel like we gave him what he wanted." For his part, Heap held to his view that the board had brazenly usurped his election administration powers. "I think we need clarification from the court on this issue," he told reporters after the meeting. Now, as his lawsuit nears the finish line, there was pressure to settle the matter, Heap said. "Which tells me they think they're going to lose this lawsuit. I am not ready to hand my statutory duties over to them." Corey Langenhofer, an attorney representing the board in a suit against Heap, described a frustrating lack of engagement toward a settlement with Heap's attorney. Langenhofer called the remaining unresolved power-sharing details vanishingly small. Supervisor Thomas Galvin, a Republican, said he thought he had a handshake agreement to work cooperatively with Heap in December 2024 before Heap took over his duties, and as Galvin was about to ascend to chair for the board for a year. He called Arizona's bifurcated election duties between supervisors and recorders a forced marriage and highlighted a proposal to evenly divide information technology staff between the board and the recorder as a sign of how far the board was going to avert litigation that has dragged on for nearly a year. Supervisor Mark Stewart, a Republican, was the only board member who cast Heap as dealing in good faith with the panel. Speaking remotely from a time zone 3 hours ahead of Arizona's, Stewart said he emphasized the challenge facing the board and Heap. He reiterated his view the board should not have changed the recorder's duties before Heap took office. Before Heap took office in January 2025, the board took over technical duties under an agreement with the outgoing recorder, Stephen Richer, a Republican who lost that job to Heap in the GOP primary months earlier. Adding to already strained relations were the unproven allegations by his staffers of disenfranchisement, claims that echo the kind of election denialism favored by President Donald Trump and supported by Heap. At a January 26 court hearing, Stone and Senior Director of Voter Registration Janine Petty claimed the county's provisional ballot carrying process had disenfranchised voters. At the same hearing, the recorder's chief information officer, Brian Colby, admitted to making false testimony regarding the election information technology systems. 2 days later, Heap met with the board at a routine budget meeting where he said that no voter disenfranchisement had taken place since he assumed office. The meeting devolved into shouting and accusations of lying. The board responded to the contradictory statements by issuing subpoenas to the recorder's three employees. The court, however, blocked the subpoenas, leading the board to summon Heap instead. Heap has positioned himself as a stalwart supporter of claims that elections are seriously botched. He was on hand February 13th as Homeland Secretary Kristi Noem argued for passage of legislation that would require federal IDs to register to vote and cited Arizona as an absolute disaster on elections. Asked for an Arizona example of disenfranchisement, she claimed, Noem brushed it off, saying, "I am sure there's many of them." Heap later released a statement purporting to have used a federal database to identify 137 people out of a batch of 62,000 who are not U.S. citizens. Of those, 60 voted in previous elections, Heap said. His office has not responded to the Arizona Republic's request for specifics about those cases. Beyond the inter-party split on the right, Trump's broader critics view the move to pass tighter voting restrictions and station immigration officials near polling sites as setting the stage for delegitimizing the 2026 elections. You are listening to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, February 20th, 2026. I'm your son, Sounds of Arizona, volunteer broadcaster Joe Napoli. You can take Sun Sounds with you on our Sun Sounds mobile app available for both Android and iPhone. The lead article on the Valley and State page is "It's Finally Snowing, Here's Where to Go Play" by Michael Salerno. Snow is blanketing much of the U.S. as winter weather systems move through, and parts of Arizona have snow in the forecast. The National Weather Service predicted a 100% chance of snow in Flagstaff on Wednesday, February 18th, with heavy accumulations from 6 to 8 inches possible. Flagstaff is one of Arizona's snowiest cities, According to the Weather Service, more than 105 inches fell in 2024. Even a light dusting would be welcomed. So far, it hasn't snowed much this winter or last winter in Arizona. But when snow piles up in powdery white messes, Arizonans can't resist the opportunity to play in it. Places to play in the snow are plentiful in Arizona's higher elevations. Most are dependent on natural snowfall, but some, like ski resorts and snow tubing parks, make their own. Check with your destination before heading out to see if there is enough snow. What part of Arizona has snow? Snow is common in Arizona's higher elevations above 7,000 feet. Most winters, snow can be found from Williams to Flagstaff and across the Mogollon Rim from Payson to Eggers-Springville. And the north rim of the Grand Canyon gets an average of 126 inches of snow per year, according to the National Weather Service's Flagstaff Forecast Office. Where can I play in the snow in Arizona? Flagstaff, Williams, and the White Mountains of eastern Arizona have an assortment of snow play destinations. Canyon Coaster Adventure Park. This park in Williams has two conveyor lifts for snow tubing. Day sessions are $50 for adults and $35 for children at canyoncoasteradventurepark.com. Flagstaff Snow Park. This Fort Tuthill County Park attraction makes snow for its 8 groomed tubing runs, including a kiddie hill. There's also a general play area where people can build snowmen, but it depends on natural snow, said Jonathan Allen, president of Flagstaff Snow Park. All of our runs are in very good condition, considering we haven't received any snow, Allen said. 6 of the park's 7 tubing runs are open, though the play area only has about 1/2 inch of natural snow. Check the park's latest conditions before your visit. Open Friday nights, weekends, and holidays through early March. Tickets start at $23 for adults and $18 for children for a half-day session, which includes a snow tube rental. Reservations are required at flagstaffsnowpark.com. Fort Tuthill County Park. The Coconino County Park, where Flagstaff Snow Park is located, is itself worth visiting for winter recreation, with plentiful snow play areas and trails for snowshoeing and cross-country skiing when there is sufficient snow. Free admission, see coconino.az.gov. Coconino County Parks. Two other Coconino County Parks, Matt Ryan County Natural Area in Cheyenne Village and Rogers Lake County Natural Area in Coconino National Forest, southwest of Flagstaff, have trails that can be used for cross-country skiing. Coconino National Forest. Access to trails for cross-country skiing and snowboarding can be found via the Peak View parking area and Kenry Park along US 180 north of Flagstaff. These trails are only open for winter recreation after it snows, said Bradley Smith, spokesperson for Coconino National Forest. Go to fs.usda.gov. Apache Sitgreaves National Forest. These adjacent forests accompany a good deal of eastern Arizona's White Mountains. Williams Valley Recreation Area off US 180-191 near Alpine is a winter sports hotspot. It's where Toboggan Hill Trailhead is, which offers tubing, sledding, and cross-country skiing. Williams Valley is open, but only a few inches of snow on the ground at the moment, said Tammy Slade, spokeswoman for Apache Sitgreaves National Forest. Sunrise Park Resort. The ski resort in the White Mountains has snow tubing, cross-country skiing, and snow biking, as well as downhill slopes for skiing and snowboarding. The Sunrise Apache Alpine Coaster, a mountain coaster whose track covers more than 1/2 mile, and climbs and dips through the trees, is open Thursdays through Sundays and on holidays. Flagstaff City Parks. Thorpe Park, Buffalo Park, and Fox Glen Park also offer snow play areas, said Ryan Mendazo of Discover Flagstaff, the city's tourism promoter. Buffalo Park also has ski and snowshoe trails, he said. Where can't I play in the snow in Arizona? Pulling over on highway shoulders to play in the snow is not advised. The Arizona Department of Transportation says it's dangerous and it can obstruct first responders on their way to a crash. We encourage people to visit Flagstaff for winter activities, but please do it safely, Randazzo said. Interstates 40 and 17, as well as Highway 180 and Lake Mary Road, do not allow stopping or snow play. Does Arizona have a ski resort? Arizona has 2 major ski resorts. Arizona Snow Bowl in the San Francisco Peaks near Flagstaff and Sunrise Park Resort in the White Mountains on the Fort Apache Reservation. Snow Bowl has 777 skiable acres according to its website, with a base elevation of 9,200 feet and a lift serve elevation of 11,500 feet. There are 8 lifts and 61 trails, the longest of which is 2 miles. Trails are for skiing and snowboarding only. There are no designated snow play areas. Sunrise Park Resort has 1,200 skiable acres and 67 trails. Its longest trail is just under 3 miles. It has a base elevation of 9,300 feet and tops out at 10,700 feet. Michael Salerno is an award-winning journalist who covers travel and tourism. You can reach Michael by email at michael.salerno@gannett.com. The featured photo on today's Valley and State page is of some high school boys wearing red shirts and cheering. The caption reads, "The Arcadia Titans student section cheers on their team against the Central Bobcats at Arcadia High School Gym during the first round of the Open Division State Boys Basketball Tournament on February 18th. Next is an article titled, "E. coli petting zoo law rejected. Panel bill a knee-jerk reaction to outbreak," by Robert Anglin. Hand washing to prevent the spread of E. coli proved a step too far for Arizona lawmakers. Months after an E. coli outbreak at the state fair sickened dozens of people and left several children hospitalized with a life-threatening condition, a group of senators rejected a law to require hand-washing stations at petting zoos in the state. Members of the Senate Committee on Natural Resources refused to advance the bill, calling it a knee-jerk reaction to the illness that can be deadly and saying hand-washing is an issue of personal responsibility. Senator Frank Carroll, Republican of Sun City West, suggested without evidence that children who suffered kidney failure as a result of the infection had some kind of pre-existing condition. Meanwhile, Senator Janae Shamp, Republican of Surprise, who registered nurse, simply voted nay. The committee hearing ended with a 4-4 vote about 20 minutes after it began, leaving supporters surprised and disappointed. A tie vote means a proposal at the legislature does not advance. "The evidence clearly shows petting zoos are a high risk," said Senator John Kavanaugh, Republican of Fountain Hills, who sponsored the bill. "We know one infected animal could spread it to 100 people. Health advocate Mary McGonnell Martin, vice president of a nonprofit that first raised alarms about the E. coli outbreak at the state fair, put it more bluntly. "I get frustrated that money and special interests are more important than kids' lives," she said after the hearing. "It's sad they don't think the life of a child is important." A November investigation by the Arizona Republic tied E. coli cases to the state fair, with multiple parents reporting their children became sick after coming in contact with a pig at the fair's petting zoo. Dozens were sickened, with several with acute kidney failure. As a number of cases rose in October and November, the Arizona Department of Health Services did not disclose potential sources, the number of cases, the geographic spread, or any potential connections. E. coli test results show state and county officials were aware that the Arizona State Fair was the source of the outbreak, even as they withheld details from the public. State Fair officials confirmed there were no hand-washing stations with soap and running water attached to the petting zoo exhibit, which is located in the fair's agricultural building. There were hand-washing stations and full restrooms inside the building, but hand sanitizer was all that was available at the zoo itself. Hand sanitizer does not eliminate some strains of E. coli. Bill sought safeguards for Arizona petting zoos. Senate Bill 1082 sought to require commercial petting zoos restrict access to animals and ensure patrons wash their hands upon leaving. It would have prohibited outside food from being brought into the petting zoo and called for signage warning of risks. Kavanaugh's legislation would, for the first time, have given state health inspectors authority over petting zoos and animal exhibits and the ability to fine operators no more than $100 per violation. Calls for legislation came after a blistering critique by former State Health Department Director Will Humble, who, after the outbreak, said the state had abandoned past safety practices. Humble, who is the executive director of the nonprofit Arizona Public Health Association, called the E. coli outbreak preventable. Humble did not speak at the hearing. A representative of Arizona's $23 billion agricultural industry challenged the bill. I think there was a lot more story behind the E. coli situation than came out at the state fair, Patrick Bray of the Arizona Farm and Ranch Group said. I will tell you, first-hand experience, if you want to take a tour of the state fair, we can show you all the permanent restroom facilities that have hand washes. He said there were big flaws in the legislation. We're focused on this petting zoo deal, but you can go into a pound and pet every dog and not worry about washing your hands, he said. You've got to take personal responsibility as parents as ourselves when you're working with animals. It's called using a little common sense. Petting zoos have high risks for E. coli. Petting zoos have been sources of outbreaks of E. coli strain known as STEC or shingatoxin-producing E. coli bacteria, which causes vomiting, bloody diarrhea, cramps, and dehydration that can lead to kidney failure. Outbreaks have been traced to fairs, farms, and zoos, including one at the San Diego County Fair in 2019, responsible for the death of a 2-year-old. Bill Marler, a food safety lawyer in Seattle, has tracked E. coli cases for years. Fairs, petting zoos, and other animal exhibits have been increasingly linked to E. coli, he warned in a fair and petting zoo safety sheet on his website. Marler represents two Arizona families whose kids were hospitalized in the outbreak. E. coli is a shortened name of a bacterium called Escherichia coli. It is found in the environment, foods, and intestines of people and animals. Some strains of E. coli aren't dangerous, but others can be fatal. It can cause infections, pneumonia, and kidney failure. E. coli typically spreads through contact with contaminated food, but it can be transmitted through people or animals. Most people infected with E. coli experience diarrhea, severe stomach cramps, and vomiting, and recover within 1 week. Children younger than 5, older adults, and people with weakened immune systems more likely to develop hepatomic uremic syndrome. They are just ignorant of what it can do. Committee members at the legislature displayed a fundamental lack of understanding of E. coli, McGonigal Martin said after the hearing. I don't think they grasp how serious STEC is, she said. They're just ignorant of what it can do. Their logic is not connected to reality. McGonigal Martin, who came from California to testify at the hearing, said she worked with 4 families in Arizona whose children were hospitalized for days and weeks after contracting E. coli at the fair. McGonigal Martin is a retired high school counselor whose 7-year-old son was hospitalized for 56 days in 2006 with an E. coli infection that turned into hemolytic uremic syndrome. Her organization, Parker's Promise, provides emotional support, medical guidance, and education about the dangers of what the group calls environmental pathogens, of which STEC is one of the worst. It also organizes fundraisers for victims whose medical costs can run into hundreds of thousands of dollars. Summerlee of Gilbert, whose daughter was hospitalized for 4 days with STEC, is among the parents who reached out to Parker's Promise. Lee told the Republic her 16-year-old daughter stopped to pet a pig inside the zoo enclosure while at the fair on October 26 with her boyfriend. It was the only animal she touched. Her boyfriend, who did not touch the animal, did not get sick. Jeannie Tribus of Phoenix shared a similar account. Her 12-year-old daughter spent nearly 3 weeks at Phoenix Children's Hospital undergoing 2 blood transfusions and dialysis after her kidneys shut down. We've seen this happen before. Karen Michael, who attended the hearing, said she was devastated by the committee's vote. I like to say I'm surprised, the Phoenix area resident said, but we've seen this happen before. Michael's husband, Cecil, is a retired pediatrician and former chief of medical staff at Banner Thunderbird Medical Center, wrote a letter supporting the legislation. He said the bill created a reasonable preventative standard to protect children. I have diagnosed and treated patients with STEC infections and know how deadly these infections are, especially to young children, he wrote. He said requiring petting zoo visitors to use hand-washing stations is a straightforward public health measure. Hand-washing with soap and running water is the most effective, evidence-based intervention to reduce pathogen transmission following animal contact, Michael said. Robert Anglin is an investigative reporter for The Republic. Reach him at robert.anglin@arizonarepublic.com. The next article brings us more news from the state capitol and is titled, Arizona Senator Seeks to Criminalize Excessive Marijuana Smoke and Odor by Ray Stern. Senator J.D. Mesnard doesn't want to have the Daddy, what's that smell? Talk with his 6-year-old daughter. A neighbor somewhere on his block is forcing the conversation. With the cool winter weather, the windows are open at the Mesnard Chandler residence and occasionally let in the strong scent of marijuana. Mesnard's not sure what house it's coming from, saying he knows his immediate surrounding neighbors are not the issue. Mesnard has the power as a state senator to do something about the problem. He's introduced legislation this year that would criminalize excessive marijuana smoke and odor as a criminal public nuisance. Violators could face a misdemeanor charge if they're caught as the source of the smoke. Mesnard said he believes Arizonans are ready for his proposed law. Many people stayed silent on the issue after the state legalized marijuana in 2020 for all adults 21 and older. But now, with legal recreational marijuana a reality for several years, Mesnard said complaints about the smell are frequent and his phone blew up after he dropped the bill. He said he's heard from a number of people who say they're sick and tired of being exposed to or having their kids exposed to marijuana smoke. It's presumed that the creation of excessive marijuana smoke and odor is injurious to health, indecent, inoffensive to the sentences, and an obstruction of the free use of property that interferes with the comfortable enjoyment of life or property and is a public nuisance, the bill states. Public smoking of marijuana, already illegal. People who got smoking pot in public prior to the 2020 law were routinely hauled off to jail because possessing any amount of marijuana without a medical marijuana card was a felony back then. The recreational marijuana states consumers cannot smoke marijuana in a public place or open space, and that a person who smokes marijuana in a public place or open space is guilty of a petty offense. A petty offense might bring a fine of $300, but police and prosecutors told the Arizona Republic in 2024 that officers usually don't bother with such violations. The law also says it's illegal to consume marijuana or marijuana products while driving, operating, or riding in the passenger seat or compartment of any vehicle. Violating that law could result in a DUI. The state's smoke-free Arizona law bans smoking in most enclosed public spaces and workplaces regardless of what's being smoked. But smoking marijuana on private property, including backyards, is legal even if a neighbor can smell it. The 2020 law can't be changed by the legislature without a three-quarters majority vote, but it's unclear if Mesnard's smoke bill would constitute a change to the voter-approved law. That's why Mesnard is running two bills for the same issue that differ only by their final process. If either passes the Arizona House and Senate, one requires the governor's signature, the other is a contingency plan if the first bill fails. It would send the proposed law directly to voters who would decide the issue in November's election. How the law would work? If Mesnard's bill becomes law, the next time he smells marijuana wafting into his house, he could call police. He acknowledges such a call may not be a priority for authorities. I can call the police, and they can take a while to get there. Maybe they have to figure out which house it's coming from, he said. Like, I get it. It's not easy, but it doesn't mean you sort of don't have laws to try to keep people safer, however. That's what this is. If an officer catches someone expelling excessive marijuana smoke and odor, even on private property, the person can be slapped with a citation for a criminal nuisance, a Class 3 misdemeanor. The bill would also add marijuana smoke to another statute on public nuisance, which is similar, but could result in a Class 2 misdemeanor conviction. First-time misdemeanors usually don't result in jail time. A landlord who knowingly allows tenants to fill an area with marijuana smoke could also be held liable under the law, Mesnard said. He wasn't sure the bill would apply to vaping marijuana, he said. The bill is expected to be heard February 20th in the Senate Judiciary and Elections Committee. Pro-marijuana group opposes bill. A spokesperson for the National Organization of the Reform Marijuana Laws in Arizona told the Republic it opposes Mesnard's idea because it creates vague policy for consumers. Excessive smoking is not defined in these measures, which could lead to liens on a person's property and or criminal charges, said Allison Stein, NORML Director of Special Projects. The statement added the group's members share Mesnard's concern about children inhaling marijuana smoke, but the current scientific evidence does not demonstrate that typical outdoor secondhand marijuana smoke causes intoxication in children. Reach the reporter at rstern@arizonarepublic.com or 480-276-3900. 3237. We have a USA Today article titled "Former Prince Arrested, Suspected of Misconduct" by Kim Hengard. British police have arrested Andrew Mountbatten Windsor on suspicion of misconduct in public life, according to multiple news outlets in the United Kingdom. The UK's Thames Valley Police said in a February 19th statement that they arrested an unnamed man in his 60s and were carrying out searches at addresses in Norfolk and Berkshire, adding that an investigation had been opened. The Daily Telegraph newspaper reported that 6 unmarked police cars and around 8 plainclothes police officers were seen arriving at Wood Farm on the Sarringham Estate in Norfolk, England, where Andrew recently moved. The BBC was first to report the development. O'Brien Grandison, a professor of policing at the UK's Birmingham City University, said in email comments that Andrew is the first senior royal to be arrested in modern history. The specific police allegations under investigation have not been released. British police said earlier in February that officers were considering allegations drawn from files recently released by the U.S. government that King Charles' younger brother passed confidential information to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The former prince has faced intense scrutiny over his friendship with Epstein and was stripped of his royal titles in 2025 over those links. Andrew, who turned 66 on the day of the reported arrest, has denied any wrongdoing and said he regrets the friendship. He has not responded to requests for comment following the latest Epstein files published by the U.S. Justice Department. In one photo that appeared in the files released by the Justice Department in relation to the U.S. investigation of Epstein, the former prince can be seen kneeling on all fours over an unidentified woman on the ground. I have learned the deepest concern about the news of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and suspicion of misconduct in public office, King Charles III said in a statement. What now follows is the full, fair, and proper process by which this issue is investigated in the appropriate manner and by the appropriate authorities. In this, as I have said before, they have our full and wholehearted support and cooperation. Let me state clearly, the law must take its course. No public comments have been made by Prince William and Princess Kate, though USA Today has learned they support the King's statement. The King shocked the public by attending a fashion show later that day, the opening of London Fashion Week, sitting front row at British Nigerian designer Tolu Koker's show and clapping excitedly. Some U.S. lawmakers and the family of his most prominent accuser, Virginia Giuffre, who alleged in her posthumous memoir that she was a victim of Epstein's sex trafficking ring, have appealed to Andrew to testify in the United States about his Epstein connections. The former prince reached an out-of-court settlement with Giuffre in 2022. Andrew denied any wrongdoing in the case, and he did not admit any liability. Giuffre died by suicide in April 2025. Tyjun Moran and Laura Strugillo of USA Today contributed to this article. Next is an article by Stacey Bartschinger titled "Hobbs MIA After Dem Governors Get Trump Snub." Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs planned to skip a governor's dinner at the White House this weekend, long before it became embroiled in partisan controversy, according to her staff. Hobbs had a scheduling conflict, her spokesperson Lillian Soto said, declining to provide more details. President Donald Trump's decision not to invite 2 Democratic governors, Jared Polis of Colorado and Wes Moore of Maryland, to the dinner became something of a political saga of its own. The dinner is held during the bipartisan National Governors Association Conference from February 19th to 21st, and Trump's decision to exclude just 2 governors has prompted civil rights groups to question the president. The president also reportedly invited only Republican governors to a meeting during the conference, though he disputed that claim after Republican Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, who leads the NGA, pulled the organization out of the meeting. Trump then said all governors except for Polis and Moore were invited and wrote on social media that Stitt had misstated the situation. Regardless, 18 of the nation's 24 Democratic governors said in a statement issued by the Democratic Governors Association that they would boycott the dinner if all governors weren't invited. Hobbs did not join her fellow Democratic leaders in pushing back on Trump's selective invitees. Our approach is simple, her re-election campaign spokesperson Michael Bayer said in a text message. We focus on results for Arizona. Sometimes that means joining other governors. Sometimes it means taking a different approach. Though similar in name and acronym, the NGA and DGA have different roles. The NGA is a bipartisan organization that brings state leaders together on policy and training, whereas the DGA is a political one that helps elect Democratic governors across the nation. The DGA contributed over $9 million to the Arizona Democratic Party to get Hobbs elected in 2022, state records show. Hobbs said in October she was reconsidering the state's membership in the National Governors Association, which costs about $130,000 a year. Her comments came after some Democrats blasted the NGA for not condemning Trump's attempts to dispatch National Guard members across state lines. Soto said there was no update to share about whether Arizona would continue to pay dues to the organization. Reach reporter Stacey Bartschenger at stacey.barchenger at arizonarepublic.com or 480-416-5669. We wrap hour one with an article titled What to Know as Nancy Guthrie Search Enters Day 19 by Ray Corvipus Jr. The search for Nancy Guthrie entered its 19th day as authorities continued analyzing biological evidence removed from her Catalina Foothills home and declined to release new details about potential suspects. The Pima County Sheriff's Department spokesperson, Angelica Carrillo, said that the number of DNA profiles being examined would not be disclosed because of the active investigation. Officials also have not said when the lab results might be made public. The update follows earlier DNA testing on gloves found about 2 miles from Guthrie's home that did not match evidence collected at the property and did not produce a hit on the FBI's national database. Guthrie, 84, was reported missing February 1st after authorities said she was abducted from her home. On February 10th, the FBI retrieved footage and images from her doorbell camera recorded the night she disappeared. Investigators have said they are pursuing every lead. As the search for Nancy Guthrie continues into a third week with few public answers, live streamers and online true crime personalities have flooded the area around her home, broadcasting real-time speculation to large audiences and at times spreading misinformation, prompting Sheriff Chris Nanos to publicly clear family members and urge professionalism, while elected officials criticized what they called interference and the spread of unverified claims. That will do it for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, February 20th, 2026. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, thanking you for listening to Hour 1 and encouraging you to stay tuned for Hour 2, as well as our DVS movie at 6 p.m. this evening, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And for all of us here at Sun Sounds of Arizona, I wish you a very pleasant weekend.